some Q&A. So Tiffany, I think you've got some teed up for us.
I do. And really quickly, before we jump back into the questions, just want to give everyone a reminder. We have received probably 25 to 30 questions in the Q&A box already. We have queued up, but we encourage you to continue to submit questions in that Q&A. We will get through as many as we can. As a reminder, on the Zoom taskbar, you can click on the Q&A and enter those there. And if you're in the conference room with the RTC staff, you can write those down and they will submit them for you. So with that, we do have a number queued up. So first of all, I'm going to pose two questions that are both related to the station locations and stops that I think can be answered together. So the questions are, is it true that stops and platforms could be added at later times if the public desires? And related to that, someone asked, during commute times, is it possible to run an express train, something, for example, with 1 to 2 stops between Watsonville and Santa Cruz, or does a single track system prevent that?
All right, that was a great question, Tiffany, from the community. Thank you for that. Mark, are you able to jump in and answer these questions?
Yeah, sure. So as we have had conversation, there's been interest, for example, in some of the stations that may not be a part of regular service because, for example, they serve a beach. And the time that's there, typically, this is something on a single line system that we would treat as what I will call an exception stop, wherein at certain times of the year or certain trips of the day, that train might be scheduled to stop at that location, but only during certain trips or, say, on the weekend or time when there's high demand to that location. Running an express train with fewer stops really is limited by how much of the system is, in fact, a double track versus a single track system. And even with a double track system, that can prevent some scheduling challenges as it relates to where trains would need to meet and pass each other. Again, it's those things aren't out of the question, but a lot of them have to do with the trade-off between the cost of the additional track and or if the track doesn't fit within the right-of-way, what the right-of-way needs may be to be able to accommodate a double track system versus a single track system, which admittedly a single track system can be more limiting in terms of the operations that you can provide for special locations or special services. None of those things are out of the question. The cost and how they dovetail with what would be a regularly scheduled service becomes the conversation.
Okay.
Great, thank you, Mark. And I'll add, because I saw one of the other questions popping up in the chat, in the Q&A, that you know, part of the question, as Mark mentioned, is where do we have our passing sidings and what is a single track versus a double track service provide? And the current right-of-way for the Santa Cruz branch rail line is obviously limited in many places. And the opportune, the most opportunistic or best locations for some of these passing sidings don't necessarily match up well to where we have larger areas for right of way. So when we get further into preliminary engineering and final design, we're able to kind of do the cost benefit of providing for longer passing sidings that would allow for train meets to increase the service speed or versus the cost for doing that.
All right. Thank you, Riley and Mark. The next question from the community is also related to station locations. And the question asks, can you tell us more about where the Beach Street stop would be located? If it were at the Marine Sanctuary Center, it seems like it could serve a very similar group of riders as the old Santa Cruz Depot Park location, yet still allow the train to serve the west side.
great. And another good question. And Mark, I'll have pitch it over to you as well.
So the location of the beach the Beach Street station is one of the things that's still in flux as we work through some of the engineering detail that Chris referred to as the alignment, particularly in that area of Beach Street in front of the boardwalk and roughly from the river over to Pacific. There are a lot of details to still be refined in that area. And part of that is determining where the stop can be best accommodated while having the least interference with what happens with other travel along that roadway, not only auto travel, but bike and pedestrian travel. But that is one of the things as we work towards the next opportunities for public conversation at the end of April, we'll be more prepared to address specifically in terms of the location that best accommodates the needs while minimizing the conflicts with the other things on the street.
All right, thank you for responding, Mark. I will read out the next question. And again, I'm gonna combine two similar questions related to ridership projections. So the first question asks, have you looked at streetlight data as part of your ridership projections? And the second question asks, in terms of ridership projections, has the fact that Santa Cruz has an aging population, some of who may age out of being able to drive or bike, been considered when estimating usage of the rail service? Riley, I will pass that off to you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Tiffany. And Mark, I'll lean over to you again for this question.
Sure. So as I understood, the question was twofold. The first was about streetlight data, and the second was on aging demographics and the change of the community in terms of abilities to travel. And actually, the answer to those questions is kind of interrelated. So streetlight data tends to be data that's gathered from mobile devices. And so essentially, if you think that Big Brother isn't watching you every time you go somewhere and you take your cell phone with you, it's that data is being collected. And that data is able to tell some things about how you're traveling by the speed, the direction, the path that you follow. And that information gets aggregated then and provides a big data source to provide a lot of information about kind of where the areas of congestion are, the points from which there are a lot of people traveling back and forth, the ways that they're traveling. And it's a good, a pretty real-time source in terms of what you can look at and see how people were using transportation in Santa Cruz County or anywhere else at a certain point in time. What it doesn't do well is look at demographics from the standpoint of understanding the future of the population and also the attitudinal part of travel. And by attitudinal, what I mean is that the travel demand tools that we use that help us forecast ridership, what they're really trying to do is predict what human behavior is going to be. And they're doing that not only based on knowing the options that a community has and understanding how a community is traveling today, but also having some understanding as to how you might change your travel with other options that are available to you. And for example, that's information that often comes from the census data. The census has a whole module in what's called Journey to Work that is a lot of information that many people complete as a part of the census that talks about how they travel, when they travel, what the determinants of their choice of travel are. And part of that also takes into account people's changing options during different cycles of life in terms of what their attitude is about the things that would influence their travel choice. It's that human behavior that comes from the attitudinal part that becomes critical as a part of this evaluation, because while streetlight and a lot of others, there are a lot of other sources that provide us with really good data on what is being used and how people are traveling today. What we're interested in understanding is what are the things that are important to you that would make you choose the way you travel in the future or the way you would travel today if there was something to use that's not in place today. I cannot answer for you specifically whether it is street light data specifically that is providing some of the data that goes into the travel, the regional model. But there are other services like Streetlight that also provide a lot of that collected data on the ways that people travel that does become a part of the baseline in terms of the model understanding how people are using the system today. And I hope that answered the question as succinctly as I could. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, thanks. Before I read the next question, I do just want to share, it's 7:05 now. We know we advertised the end time for this meeting at 7:15 because we do have so many questions and the presentation ran a little bit longer than we anticipated. Our RTC and HDR team is willing to stay on the line a little bit longer to respond to more questions. So just as a heads up, we will probably stay on for about a 10 additional minutes to try to get through a few more questions for everyone on the line this evening. And with that, the next question I do have is asking, could it be an issue calling it an intercity rail project when it really isn't that type of service that we need? Fewer stops mean less convenience for travelers. Riley, I'll let you start that one.
Right. So I think what I'm hearing with the question, and Mark, I'll lean on you again for elaboration on the answer. But I think what it is an issue with regards to the funding source if we were in aligning with intercity rail service. That type of a service on the branch line. When we do go through service planning, and Caltrans is about to kick off a Central Coast Corridor service development plan, we will, in order to qualify for Federal Railroad Administration grant funding through the Corridor ID program, need to be providing a service that does align with what intercity rail goals and priorities are. So as we go through that process, that is the approach we're taking. If we weren't going to be providing strictly an intercity rail service, if we were providing a commuter rail service and we weren't having the ability to interline on the Union Pacific main line, for instance, then FRA would potentially not grant us the ability to move through the Corridor ID program. So our intent would be to align with the program requirements. Mark, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that's very well summarized, Riley. And I think this goes back to a conversation early in the presentation, as we've discussed before, also is the difference between the Federal Transit and the Federal Railroad Administration funding programs. And the Federal Railroad Administration program through the CID program provides a greater opportunity for funding of the costs associated with this project if it is in fact meeting the requirements of intercity service. And the trade-off for that is that when we look at what, for example, light rail or a more frequent service that's not qualifying as intercity service would cost in terms of implementation, the part of that cost that would be borne locally would be significantly higher because that program under Federal Transit does not provide the same level of funding as a percent of a project as the CID program does. And so that's an important differentiation because as we look at the cost of the program and how the program could be funded, being able to maximize both state and federal dollars with a lower amount of local dollars to get an investment has been an important part of this discussion.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Mark. And Mark, do we have the ability at this point to to clarify, as we've been working through the ridership forecast modeling, is there by going from a larger set of stations that are more frequent down to a smaller set of inner city rail type station locations, is there a significant expected drop in ridership because of that?
There could be, Riley. There could be some drop in ridership. I don't think that it is substantial when we look at the overall system, but we are still going to test that because what we're doing is with this list of initial stations, that's our starting point for the modeling to see how those stations respond. If there are stations that don't respond as we expect them to, one of the ways to test them is to add other stations in to see if there's a different location that people might be more responsive to. The other option at times is there are times we're actually taking a station that doesn't perform well out of the list and reducing the number improves the ridership or has a nominal effect because of the fact that the increase in time, the decrease in time, the faster trip becomes an additional attractor for people in terms of the decision that they're going to make in their choice to travel that outweighs the few people that might have been inconvenienced by that location going away. That's part of the back and forth that will continue to be evaluated as we move forward with the development of the concept.
Great. That was a good additional information, Mark. Thank you. All right, back to you, Tiffany.
Sure. And I'm going to transition that answer over to a question asking for some clarification on the estimated travel time. And that question asks, is the 40 to 45 minute travel time estimate from Pajaro to Depot Park or Pajaro to Natural Bridges Station?
I believe the 45 minutes was to Natural Bridges in the evaluation that was done and developed. And again, that number is a little conservative right now because we are still fine-tuning. Part of that modeling effort is fine-tuning the operation of the train to make sure that we accommodate and have passing tracks in or sidings in the locations that are optimal for train meets as the trains go back and forth and have to pass each other along the line. So as we refine that, if we find places where we can adjust those train meets and have a passing track that best suits the schedule, there may still be the opportunity to take a couple of minutes off of that estimate. But right now, it's a conservative estimate based on what we know and the locations that we're looking at and refining those stations and the passing tracks.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
All right. And I'm going to transition us a little bit again. We have a few questions related to some of the specific conceptual alignment slides that Chris spoke to. So the first question that I'm going to ask from those asks, the new segment 18 trail in Watsonville, it's asking, does the new segment 18 trail in Watsonville have to be relocated to Beach Street?
And I can provide that, Mark. So the segment 18 rail trail project, I want to remind that the RTC commission has had several conversations and discussions on advancing the segment 18 alignment out of the zero emission passenger rail and trail project to advance it sooner. So that work is ongoing, and the commission has took action to program money to do that. And the scope of work is being developed to do a environmental analysis for segment 18. Through milestone 2 and 3 of this project, the Zephyr project, we got feedback from the community that there was a lot of interest in a Beach Street alignment for segment 18. And a couple different options are on the table for that alignment, either wholly on Beach Street from the end of 17 all the way to the beginning of segment 19, or a couple options where the alignment goes along West Beach Street for a portion and then goes back onto the rail corridor before meeting segment 19. And part of the question is being discussed through the commissioner working groups. So there's going to be some work that the commissioners are doing to identify some of the opportunity and constraints in developing what that scope of work for segment 18 environmental document would look like. And back to you, Tiffany, unless Mark, you have something to add.
Well, I was just going to add one thing there, Riley, real quickly, because I think an important element of this that we also heard from the community, and we are also aware from a railroad operations perspective, is that section of the rail alignment that we're going to move off of to go to Beach Street, that is an area that goes through an industrial area, and there are a lot of switches that take or have the opportunity for freight switching in and out of private property along the railroad corridor there. And if you think about this from the perspective of being a bicyclist, if you're riding on a trail like that and you get to a point where the railroad is coming in at a fairly narrow angle to cross the trail, that's not a good situation as a bicyclist to cross because of the risk of you getting caught in the flange adjacent to the rail and what that means for your ride. So the way that has to be addressed for a safety perspective and for the interest of both the railroad as well as the bicyclist is for those crossings to be nearly as perpendicular as possible. What that means as a bicyclist is you end up with this zigzag trip because as you get from one crossing or one of those switches to the next, you're going to have to turn to cross it, then straighten out and continue along. And depending on what's happening with some of those crossings, they may also have to be gated depending on the amount of activity that occurs there in the future. Whether as a bicyclist or not, we appreciate it. The reality is that those railroad switches have been there for decades. And they have rights them also in terms of their operation. And so the way to minimize the risk for the bicyclist and give the bicyclist the best opportunity to travel through that area of the city is really to take the bicycle away from all those industrial switches that are in that area that create that conflict.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. That's a key consideration that we've been discussing, as well as the key connections to some other locations and trail networks that would be provided better through potential different alignments than along the rail corridor.
All right, I will move on to our next question. And this question is related to the alignment in Santa Cruz and asks, what are the benefits of alignment alternatives 3 and 4 on Beach Street?
Okay, I'll have to refer to the map showing which the 3 and 4 are.
And I can pull that up for everyone's benefit.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well. So, great, Tiffany got it. So on the alignments 3 and 4 is bringing the rail alignment away from the log ride. And the current alignment goes across the San Lorenzo River and goes underneath the flume ride in that location. Yeah, there. There's some operational constraints of the alignment as it currently is, particularly with movements of the Seaside Company's maintenance operations and maintenance vehicles through that area. And so bringing it away from that area reduces the number of conflicts through that area that we'd potentially have to design around or operational elements to accommodate those challenges. So those are the key things of alignments 3 and 4. There's both an ACRID and an aerial version of that alignment that would take it around the plume ride a little bit to the north.
All right. Thank you, Riley. The next question, I'm going to move this over to a question related to the Aptos bridges. And the question asks, since those railroad bridges over the highway only need replacement because of the highway widening, wouldn't those bridges be paid for by the highway project?
That is correct. Yeah. So the separate project is not replacing the railroad bridges that go over Highway 1 in Aptos. However, the highway auxiliary lane and bus on shoulder project is replacing those bridges to allow for the project along the highway to carry on underneath them. But in doing the bridge replacements, the design team for the highway project is actually elevating those bridges to provide for meeting clearance requirements or newer design guidance and bridge designs than the older bridges that are currently there. So it's actually the profile changes to the alignment that have been raised, you know, on the order of 1 to 2 feet that is having kind of these knock-on effects for some of the bridges over Soquel Drive and Valencia and Aptos Creek, which is what our project team is working to adjust the conceptual alignment to.
Thanks, Riley. Great. All right. And the next question asks, given what you've learned about the state rail plan and other regions' ongoing plans, what are some of the potential or likely destinations outside of Santa Cruz County that the train might serve in the future?
Okay. Mark, are you able to answer this one for us?
Well, so, you know, the benefit that this project has with the Union Pacific main line that passes through Pajaro is that main line could take you, gives you the ability to connect to things that take you all up and down the coast of California and the West Coast in general, right? At a minimum, when you look at the state rail plan and the connectivity, I think the key connection for this project, if you were to think of this as a one-seat ride, you get on the train in Santa Cruz or in Aptos and you're not going to change trains again until you get to a certain destination, that point is most likely Gilroy. And in Gilroy, you're going to have the ability to, in the future, connect with services that go into the Bay Area, into San Francisco, into other Caltrain services, as well as the Amtrak service along the coast, and all of the things, including the potential, the connectivity to high-speed rail. And so that is really kind of, I'd say, the focal point, as I look at it, of the benefit that you would have in that inner city connection that you would make coming out of Santa Cruz County and going to connect at that point. With Pajaro Station, if your trip terminated at Pajaro Station, depending on the type of service that was being operated on the main line, you might have Amtrak or other services in the future that you could connect to, or the Amtrak bus that would get you to Gilroy or to other locations to make those connections. But the beauty of this is inner city rail is that when all of those services are in place in the future and that connection is happening in Gilroy, is the ability to get on the train and have the one seat ride to go make that connection.
Great, Mark. That's a good description. And I'll add that is some of the work that is going to be led by Caltrans over the next couple, 18 months or so, is building out, fleshing out a lot of the service planning that just goes into what Mark's describing, how those efforts would work together and how the inner city rail service would enable users along the Central Coast Corridor to make those connections to other parts of the state via places like Pajaro at Pajaro Station or in Gilroy. Back to you, Tiffany.
All right. Thanks, Riley. And I think this was probably our last question we have time for this evening. So the question I'm going to go to is related back to station locations. And the question asks, what, if any, stations will be between Aptos Village and Watsonville?
Okay. Mark, would you take this one?
If you could go back to the list.
I can.
I'm sorry. Let's go to the short list, if we could. Right there. Okay. So as we mentioned earlier, this is the list where we are going to start with the data as it relates to what ridership looks like at each of these stations individually, because of the propensity that we see and what the data supports in terms of the likelihood of the type of travel and the trips that people would be using from these locations. And the intent here is right now in this concept, and again, based on looking at the information that we have, is that this Pajaro would be the end of the line. The station location, as Chris explained, that we're looking at in Watsonville is basically in the area downtown close to where the historic Watsonville station is. And that could move a little bit, and that's conversation that's ongoing with the city as it relates to some of their plans and where that station platform is best accommodated. Under this list, the next station would be Aptos. Now, again, as we go through this evaluation, depending on what we see, as well as the feedback that we get from all of you, we may look at other locations. We may test those locations once we've developed this network and see whether or not another station provides benefit or not in the system. But based on the information that we have and what we're looking at in the data right now, this is the list of the high propensity stations where we're beginning that evaluation.
Great. Okay. And I think, Mark, would you talk a little bit just briefly about maybe seasonal or exception stations and what those might mean?
Well, again, the thought here is because of the input and the interest that we've had is some of these other locations that may not generate much use on a regular basis. And again, that has a cost implication as well because it slows down the train, may detract other riders, but slowing down the train also increases the operating costs because we have to have more trains to maintain a certain schedule. Is as a part of that service, we can have locations and may identify locations where it makes sense to have a platform that is only used at certain times of the year, certain times of the day, depending on what the demand is. And so that will be a follow-on part of the evaluation, this conversation, after we've identified the stations that make sense that meet the need of the inner city service and would generate the type of ridership necessary to allow the project to continue to move forward in that program.
Perfect. Thank you, Mark. And I will wrap up the Q&A there. I think Tiffany was going to do the same. But I'd like to invite everybody that's on the webinar today, as well as those who are viewing this at a later date, to take an opportunity to sign up on our mailing list or visit our project website to get on, get additional information and also to sign up for our communications to get our newsletters and e-blasts when they get sent out. You can also email us with questions at the theprt@sccrtc.org email. And I'd like to also say that we've recorded all of the questions that were asked of the during the presentation. There were quite a few more than we were able to get to this evening. But we do have a list that we are putting together from the most recent information sessions that we hope to be able to put out an updated FAQ or some other sort of information to the community so that we can provide answers to some of these questions that we weren't able to get to today. And back to you, Tiffany.
Thank you, Riley. And with that, I think this concludes this meeting. We really appreciate everyone being here this evening and staying on with us a few extra minutes. And we'll look forward to seeing everybody the next time. Have a good evening.